Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI, 99.5 FM in your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And today, I'm just very happy to have a special guest with us in the air, on the air today, talking about the way you feel about yourself. Every single day, each of us battles moments of seriously undervaluing ourselves. The Undervalued Self is a book written by Elaine Aron. And Elaine's in the studio with us. Elaine, welcome to Hi. WBAI.
Hi, this is great.
This is great. Here we go. Elaine is a best-selling author of A Highly Sensitive Person. But she's also a scientist, and she's been recognized as one of the leading people helping people love themselves a little better. Elaine, let's talk about the undervalued self.
Sure. Well, I think of it as a part of ourselves that we all have and we can all fall into at times. So appreciating that, I think at the start helps us to not identify with it all the time. But the undervalued self is really an obstacle to the things that we want to do in life. If we're wanting to speak out about something really important to us, but we can't because we're afraid someone will think it's stupid, that's a great tragedy, really, because probably our thoughts are important.
So when you say the undervalued self, you mean it's the way we perceive ourselves as being less or inadequate?
Right. And that idea has been, low self-esteem has been around for a long time. What's new, I think, my approach is, I think it's tied a great deal, our undervaluing ourselves, tied to the two things that we all do socially all the time. And you watch animals, all the mammals and social animals, you know, above the ant form, social animals have hierarchies. And everybody in a group knows where they are in the hierarchy. So if you approach a pasture of horses with a carrot and the horses come over, only one horse will come up and take the carrot. The others will back away. You might see ears laid back or a tiny bit of a tiff, but everybody in that group of horses knows who's first and who's second. And we all know that in all the groups that we're in. And it's not something that we enjoy knowing, I don't think, but it's just the way we're organized as social animals.
We tend to rank ourselves in order of other social animals, trying to say, well, I'm either more or less than the other guy.
Yes, yes.
And therefore, I either get the carrot or I don't get the carrot, or
I've got to wait. Yeah, I've got to wait until the one above me gets the carrot, and then if there's any left, then I get it. And there are constant confrontations that go on in social groups, subtle ones, because the one who's at the top of the hierarchy and the next one down has more power, which we can think of as influence. When you speak your opinion, it has more influence than somebody else's opinion if you're higher in the hierarchy. So,
but at some point, we're all like, I remember I once went to a dinner at someone's home who was the person was from China, and they were serving food, and they had a bowl of rice in their hands, and they were eating meat, and they were touching the bowl of rice, and then eating the meat, and then touching the bowl of rice. And I said, what is that all about, having a handful of rice? And they said, in our tradition, you have the bowl full of rice, and you touch the meat in the bowl full of rice, and then you eat it. You have the protein. And then you take that bowl of rice that has some of the meat product in it, and you give it to the children, because they don't need the protein. We do. And so there's a hierarchy right there, but there's a natural hierarchy when you're a child, isn't there?
Oh, yes. And there is a natural hierarchy, and I talk about power in the service of love, and that's what parents hopefully have, is that they do use power and influence, but because they love the child. And the same thing with teachers and sometimes with managers, is the desire is to bring the one who's lower up to the same level, to strengthen the person.
Not to crush them and just keep making sure they don't step out of their
Place in the hierarchy.
Right.
So before we go too far down the ranking path, I just want to say that there is an equally important instinct. If you watch that same group of horses, they'll also be nuzzling each other and swatting flies off of each other. if you watch chimpanzees, they'll be fighting, the males may be fighting 1 minute, but the next thing they are doing with each other is grooming themselves. Grooming is this, picking the lice off of each other, but it's the main way of showing affection and bonding between those primates. And linking is so instinctual to us.
It's called linking. It's the first time we've used
some
the phrase.
People, right, exactly. Some people have used these phrases of ranking and linking. The one that we're used to is power and love, but power can be a little scary because this is not necessarily love that we're talking about. If you come into an office and you see somebody that's kind of pleasant and you say hi to them and you may form a link with that person and you don't love them exactly. We could say love in the sense of, the way Buddhists talk about love. But I'm talking here about a link that is formed. You see somebody, you actually like them. You there's some attraction to them. The other kinds of love are important, but that's what I'm, there's an attraction. And then I define it as wanting to be around the other, wanting to know as much as you can about the other, and wanting to help them if you can.
We're speaking with Dr. Elaine Aron, the name of the book, The Undervalued Self. Elaine, you're talking about two things now that are mm-hmm. taking place. One is ranking mm-hmm. and the other is linking. And you're saying both of these take place. Ranking, we get used to it and through our entire lives. But
right.
I think what your book addresses is you must understand the nature of ranking and linking.
Right. You've got to be able to spot it. Because many times people claim to be linking and they're actually ranking and vice versa. So the first,
what does jealousy have to do with ranking?
Oh, well, no, that's a very good question. I think the person who's jealous is feeling one down in the relationship. They feel that they don't have control whether the other person stays or leaves. They don't have control over the other's relationships. So there's A, and it's the person who's jealous is watching their partner seemingly have control over the situation. They might stay with them or they might go off with somebody else. And that mood of ranking has entered in that relationship when jealousy occurs.
When we get to the ranking and we understand ranking, you say there are a number of ways that people defend themselves.
Mm-hmm.
What are they defending themselves from?
Well, when you're defeated in a ranking situation, you feel at least momentarily depressed and ashamed.
Defeated in a ranking situation.
Right.
If I am trying to get somebody's attention
mm-hmm.
and they pay attention to someone else instead,
mm-hmm.
I could have a serious reaction or I could have
right.
no reaction.
Right, right.
But if I have a serious reaction, you're saying,
yeah.
that's a sign that what?
Well, if you have a serious reaction for some reason in that situation, it's terribly important to you, or you have a kind of a chronic view of the world and ranking, in which case every time you're rejected, it plunges you deeply into a sense of defeat because there's been cumulative defeats. And it's very natural. We see it in animals. When you're defeated, you slink off depressed, and it's thought that we do this in order to protect ourselves from going on fighting in a hopeless situation.
Would you say that depression is always the result of a ranking that got lost?
I think it almost
it's
always
It's an interesting
is.
Question, isn't it?
I yes. think it almost always
Peter
is.
Hogan, one of my teachers, used to say, depression is the result of a manipulation that failed.
Well, that's
it's
that's
kind
yeah,
of an interesting concept.
It's exactly what I'm talking about.
Right.
It's an attempt to make confrontation in a ranking situation, and you fail. Yeah.
Right.
And ranking would be power. Power would be, in some ways, a manipulation, an attempt to have more influence.
You want to have more influence. The Undervalued Self is the name of the book because you feel that yourself needs to get some kind of a leg up.
Yes, when you're in that situation, that mood. But the interesting thing is that ranking and linking, I hope people kind of used to those ideas, that
well,
they're...
Some people just tuned in and didn't
right,
hear the beginning, so we're going to have to
right.
tell them.
Like love and power. We can say it's like love and power. Because those two systems in the brain actually are separate in a way that if you're having one going on, you're not having the other going on very much. They're pretty much mutually exclusive. And there's some
ranking and linking are mutually exclusive because the ranking order of the brain occupies what part of the brain? What is the difference in neurochemistry? What's the part of the physical structure?
Well, there's more fear and anger, the amygdala and all of that, involved in a confrontation or contemplating a confrontation, which is what we're doing in a ranking. We may not be going to make any confrontation because we're already imagining the defeat. So there's more fear and anger. The linking is more associated with the dopamine system and the pleasure.
The reward stuff.
Right, the reward stuff.
So in ranking, and I know I'm going to skip to the end of the book, but we'll come back to the first chapter. In love relationships, mm-hmm. when you're having a fight with somebody you love, you're saying that's a lot to do with ranking.
It is. It's not enough to say that, but that is, you can definitely say that it is about ranking.
So you could ask yourself a question, where is the ranking phenomena here in this argument that mm-hmm. I'm having now with my wife? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's say me or somebody is having an argument with their mate right now, mm-hmm. and they're arguing about who is going to clean up the house, mm-hmm. and they're fighting about that. How would you see that as ranking?
I just have to tell you something humorous, that there was a study once done on chores done in a house. Both people estimate they do 70% of the chores. That's a very funny study. So the trouble with an argument like that is it may be an argument about that, or it may be an argument about something else. So I hate to make a generalization about it, but there are always power issues in close relationships.
You know what I think sometimes, Elaine? You may agree. I think that people argue about nothing that they're arguing about counts. I think the words that they use, I think they're fishing for words. I think their mind goes off and says, there must be a danger somewhere. Where is it? And they pick a subject. I think the real ranking is I'm trying to keep myself above water, and that's why I'm having this argument. I'm trying to keep my head up. I'm feeling powerless. So therefore, I argue with you so I could feel some kind of power. But it's not about the issue. The issues are almost never real. How could the issue be what movie you choose? Who came home for dinner on time?
I look at it more from an attachment perspective, because we're talking about a relationship. Mm-hmm. That usually when people are arguing, there's something that's been stirred up about their fear that the other person is going to abandon them or betray them in some way.
Big deal.
It is a big deal. One example I give in the book on a close relationship is people who argue before a separation. That this is a very common time for a couple to argue, or when the other person comes back. And it doesn't matter if you're the one leaving or staying, you can start one of these arguments. And it's really about, I'm mad at you for leaving me, or I'm mad, I'm upset. Sometimes it's just the fear of losing the other person. And so you might push the person away in an avoidant kind of way and say, I don't care about you at all because I'm afraid you'll never come back. And then I'll die and be miserable. I'll be suffering so much because I need you so much. So I don't need you at all. That's the kind of avoidant position in attachment theory. They talk about security, and then they talk about insecurity and two kinds of insecurity. One is the anxious, preoccupied type where the person might be more saying, please don't leave me. I don't know what I'll do if you go. Really, please don't go on this trip. They might be more obvious about it. The avoidance are lots of us, and we can all be that way at times. You don't matter to me. So you can be arguing about why aren't my clothes ready for the trip or whatever. It doesn't matter. It's usually about something deeper in a close relationship. And feeling powerless is often about feeling I can't keep you from leaving me.
I can't keep you from leaving me is the powerlessness. Mm-hmm. You know, you said something earlier to me about what it takes for two adults to maintain a strong relationship mm-hmm. today, mm-hmm. one that you and I might value.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it really, you can't just get by.
No.
With the rules that our parents handed down to us. Mm-hmm. We somehow, you've got to become,
yes,
you've got to step
said,
up to the plate.
I'm an amateur psychologist. You really have to know something about projection and attachment and, of course, arguing how to fight fairly. Like,
Could you teach us a little about projection and attachment and the different defenses that people go through when they feel they're losing in the ranking?
Right. Well, boy, everything goes in all directions. But let's go to the self-protections, because that's where we had kind of begun. I think that we all struggle, whether we know it or not, to avoid feeling ashamed. It is one of the strongest things in us. After all, if we're ashamed, we're rejected and we're out of the group, or we're at the very bottom of the group. It's a dangerous, dangerous place to be. Feeling shame is feeling worthless, and we can't stay there very long. Shame registers in the brain exactly the same part of the brain as registers physical pain. It's a horrible place to be. So,
what an interesting thought.
Yeah, it is.
Shame registers in the brain at the same place with physical pain. Where is that?
Oh, boy.
It must be New Jersey.
Right, exactly. I can't remember the fancy name for it now, but it's the same place, and rejection creates the same phenomenon in people. So if you think about what you need for survival, and you need to be in the group for survival, which is the way we all evolved, then shame is a big red light that goes on and says, I'm about to be rejected from this group. I am doing something so terrible. So we try to avoid shame,
And one of the ways to avoid shame is to shame the other person back.
Exactly. And I talk about the shame ball, you know. So,
what's a shame ball?
Oh, well, you shame me. No, I'm going to throw it back at you. You're
How would
the one
that take
shameful.
Place? So, I mean, two people would say, you're... That's the you-you-you-ing that we do, right?
Right.
That's when you hear somebody exactly. saying a sentence where all they can say is you.
Right.
And they can't say the word
right.
I.
So one of the ways we defend ourselves, the most obvious one, is blaming the other person.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty easy. We can also minimize and say, well, it never really mattered that much to me anyway. That's a good way to protect yourself from shame. You know, I don't care if I win at Scrabble. You know, never, you know, a stupid game, you know.
I don't care if that person stays with me.
Right.
She wasn't that important, or he wasn't that
exactly.
important.
That's the avoidance position, is this relationship doesn't matter that much to me, and that's how the person avoids the shame of being rejected, and that goes back to the shame of being rejected by your parent. I mean, that's the first relationship. So, but we can go off onto that.
Well, I can make believe, therefore, that I never needed my parents'
exactly.
love. The
exactly.
hell with them.
Right.
I'm too. Who needed them anyway?
And interestingly, in children, they'll be saying that in childhood, and you can see in the brain that they're getting as emotional as if they were saying, I do really need you. By adulthood, the same person with the same background, it's not even registering anymore as distress. But to go back...
You're going back to the self-protection.
That's right.
Thank you for the forays.
Yeah.
Right? Because
another
it's nice
one,
to be able to talk to somebody who speaks the same language.
Right, exactly. Another one that probably you and I are really familiar with is overachieving. Yeah.
Never heard of it. What does that
mean? Right. And just trying to be so good and the best all the time so that no one can ever catch you not doing well.
Out of reach.
It's the one that society likes us to use to avoid shame. And another one, of course, is narcissism, where you just think you're already on the top and you use everybody you can to avoid feeling ashamed, you know.
Well, we have two interpretations here of narcissism,
yes.
and I'm curious about yours. Because I always see narcissism as a person loving an image of themselves and not their real selves. That's the definition, more like the Alice Miller kind of definition. You know, it's like narcissistic self means I love this picture of myself, the picture I see in the mirror. It's not that I love me, because I don't know who I am. It's just this image of myself mm-hmm. that I love. That's
mm-hmm.
that's
well,
my interpretation. How do you see that?
Well, the research on narcissism kind of goes down to another level, which is why. And some people come to be rather entitled for one reason or another. There's lots of reasons to feel more entitled if you have more money or... your certain race or gender or whatever. In some situations, we can just feel more entitled. If you ask someone about their self-esteem in a conscious way, like, you know, you give them a measure of self-esteem, or you do an implied, an implicit measure where they don't know you're asking about, there's a million interesting ones on self-esteem. It's consistent. Deep down and on the surface, they think they're wonderful. The other kind of narcissists are those who they do know about themselves deep down. Consciously, they'll tell you they're great. Unconsciously, they're actually, their self-esteem is very low. So that's the narcissistic defense that I'm talking about. When I talk about overachieving or blaming or whatever, they can be used in a non-self-protective way. Sometimes it really is the other person's fault. Sometimes you really are the best. I mean, you have to deal with how you're going to handle being on top. So I'm trying to remember all of the six that I have in there. Another important one is refusing to compete. You know, again, it's kind of like minimizing, but it's more than that. It's like, I never think about those things.
You never think about what things?
I never think about whether you and I, whether you or I are better. So maybe one sister is better than the other at a bunch of things. So the other sister is constantly, constantly trying to prove that she's as good. But if the two sisters talk, the sister who's trying to catch up will say, I don't care about those things. I never think about those things. It's too painful to think about the fact that your whole childhood you've been the one that was less loved.
Well, now you say less loved. You're saying that the order of ranking mm-hmm. results in
yeah.
whether or not you got loved by your parents. I mean, the whole idea of trying right. to be, I mean, you're trying to be like older sisters and older right. brothers who are always, you know, doing things mm-hmm. their parents' ways. Because they're supposedly going to get loved for this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is this it? Is that the payoff? Mommy's going to love me, daddy's going to love me, and therefore you're going to love me?
Well, it is the first relationship. It's the first relationship for every mammal, is first of all with mom, and second of all with dad, if dad stays around to raise the kids. So to be rejected in that relationship, or to be, if the parent abuses that power, that is, uses it in a way that doesn't appear to the child, at least, to be caring, that's a tremendous defeat. It's the first defeat, and it's the most terrible defeat. And people who have had, you know, there's 40% of the population have insecure attachments. Now, big chunk of those are
what does that mean, insecure? Insecure?
Uh-huh. It means we're talking about adult attachment style, but we know about, by following people from childhood into adulthood, that their attachment model or their attachment style begins with the first relationship and continues somewhat consistently throughout life. Children can use all kinds of attachment figures to give themselves some security, so it doesn't have to be mother. Mother can be not so good, and maybe grandmother is good, you know. But nevertheless, when you're rejected by your primary caregivers, that I think it's instinctual that children blame themselves for that. Because after all, if a child didn't blame themselves, they wouldn't be around very long. If a child says, I better figure out, you know, how to do this right, because I must be at fault, you know, their chances of survival are better with a parent of that ilk. So
it's very difficult as a child mm-hmm. being with parents who are not secure mm-hmm. and having parents who tend to use ranking as a way of controlling children.
Right.
And therefore the child spends their life in their adult life mm-hmm. trying to outrank in some form or mm-hmm. other or defend themselves from the ranking system mm-hmm. because what they really want is to be okay. What they really want is to be loved.
Right, right. They really want to, but they cannot help but see the world in ranking terms. This is where this whole book began.
Yeah, let's stick with this for a minute. Seeing yeah. the world in ranking terms, let's get some good examples of it. A woman walks down the street and she sees her husband looking at another woman walking down the street, ranking.
Of course.
Okay?
Of course.
Somebody goes to their job and their boss says hello to them. But he gives a special smile to somebody else. Ranking.
Right.
Give me more examples of our everyday ranking.
Well, those are the ones that we all
those
appreciate. I mean, so you go to lunch with a friend and she says, gee, I just got a big promotion today and we're finally going to get married, Hank and I. Your relationship isn't going so good and you think you're going to lose your job. You may love this person you want to link with all your heart, but right now you're stuck in ranking. But it gets very...
We even compete with our best friends sometimes.
Yes, we
there
do.
Are times we see everybody around us, the people we love the most.
Yes. It's really important to accept that it's a natural instinct, that we all, at some level, in any pair, in any group, will have an idea about the ranking. It could be wrong, because this is a subjective thing. And one of the other things that I point out in the book is that we have a global self-worth, even though we shouldn't. So there's 15 different things you do in a day with other people, and your ranking isn't the same in all those relationships. But if you think about if your primary group, you know, back in the time when you only lived in one group, and you were going to confront someone, you had to have an overall global sense of whether you were strong enough, smart enough, had enough allies to successfully do this. And that global self-esteem is one of the problems that we have. Of course, we carry that around all the time wherever we go. And it gets based a lot in your primary relationships. If those go well, then, of course, you can still get kind of crushed in school or at work, but you have a better foundation. You don't see everything in terms of ranking. And one of the big bottom lines in this book, because I've said that there's these two systems, is that the solution to the undervalued self is to step out of ranking and into linking. It's as simple as that. And when that's done in research settings, for instance, you can flash at a subliminal level, hug or love or something, and people will show less prejudice towards other people. They will have higher self-esteem, even though you're not saying anything about them. You're simply raising the topic of love or hug or touch or caring, because when we're linking, we're not being in ranking. We're feeling compassionate, we're liking, we're loving, we're wanting to help, we're wanting to know more, we want to be close to the person. It's a wonderful feeling.
Well, that's a big leap going from ranking to linking, and we're going to be talking about that throughout our program today. The guest, Dr. Elaine Aron, A-R-O-N, the book, The Undervalued Self. We're talking about people who perceive themselves in an almost deficient way. Mm-hmm. I'm not good enough. Mm-hmm. And having that I'm not good enough feeling, a basis for why we make choices, sometimes choices that are not in our best interest.
Of course, because we have undervalued what we can do. And we can all fall into it easily at times, and others. So it's acute. It can be acute or it can be chronic or anywhere in between. After a big defeat, say a divorce, people undervalue themselves sometimes for a long time. After losing your job, you can undervalue yourself. But you tend to return if you don't have that sense of being chronically defeated when you were a child. That's the big one. Or I should add prejudice, for instance. That's a way to end up with an undervalued self. And for highly sensitive people who are, we'll talk about that sometime, 20% of the population, a minority, they don't fit in very well into a non-sensitive world. Again, it's kind of an experience. There's something wrong with me. I don't know why.
And there's always the group who's going to rank the other group as less.
Oh,
because it makes me superior. That's why the prejudice.
Yes. In-group, out-group is the biggest problem that human beings have.
Tell me about that in-group, out-group.
Well, here's a good one. You have people stand in a circle and go 1-2, 1-2, 1-2. You know, every other person. So one, you're a one, you're a two, you're a one, you're a two. Have the ones go to one end of the room. The twos go to the other end of the room. Ask them immediately to rank which group is better. Their group is better. Their group is better on the basis of nothing, but their 1-2 isn't a good example. You could say a red. It's an interesting thing in itself that it's very difficult to think of a pair without thinking of one is better. So salt, pepper, hot, cold, dog, cat, man, woman. Our minds not only hear the pair, but we think of slightly what is better than the other.
We're going to see today how we can step out of this paradigm, which seems to be so destructive, self-perpetuating, mm-hmm. and non-evolutionary. I mean, I want to do better than the people before me. Mm-hmm. Guest Dr. Aron, we are going to be taking a short break. When we come back, I'm going to play a little music. I want you to listen to Who Loves You, Pretty Baby by Frankie Valli, because I want you to listen to it differently. Because it's kind of the basis of all this. It's like that's the question we were all asking. And what Dr. Aron asks is, why aren't the person who's answering that question you? Who loves you, pretty baby? Well, it's you. Mm-hmm. who's going to get there. We're going to be back with you in a couple of minutes, and we're going to continue with this very exciting subject and this great guest. I want to thank you very much. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, the name of the book, The Undervalued Self, the guest, Dr. Elaine Aaron. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
AI New York.
This program on in Broadway, I remember seeing the show, and I remember seeing all the silver-haired people singing along, Who Loves Your Pretty Baby, because they grew up, as so many people did, with that big question, who loves you? Mm-hmm. Well, my guest, Dr. Elaine Aaron, who just realized that she's talking on Pacifica Radio.
Yes, tease me about that.
Come on, talk to us. So tell us about you and Pacifica.
Well, I have been a Berkeley person. The Bay Area. I went to UC Berkeley, and Pacifica Radio is just like, so, you know, I'm asked to do an interview.
Here, yeah.
Yeah, I'm asked to do an interview, and I kind of...
this guy, Armand DeMille.
You know, and I don't know for sure what radio station this is. I go where I'm invited, you know. that's my rule.
The publisher says, this may be a good interview.
Yeah. Right, and so it's so much fun. It's really fun.
And then you wind up in your homestead.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
Which is very
thrilling, because honestly, I know the intelligence of the people who are listening, and so it makes it easier to talk about this book.
Exactly.
It really does. It's the same thing when I've talked about the other book, The Highly Sensitive Person. People get it. They're right on it. They can really understand me. And I want this book to be understandable to everyone, but as we were saying earlier, if you want a relationship to work or you want yourself to work, you have to be an amateur psychologist, and some of the concepts are going to get a little complicated.
Yes, they are going to get complicated, because it's very hard to look in the mirror, you know? It's looking in the mirror with the same eyes that are looking in the mirror. Sometimes
right.
You just can't see who you are.
Well, sure, because most of what's going on is honestly unconscious. This is something that sort of came in with Freud and then got pushed out, and it's now back in totally. And social psychology, especially, they now call it, you know, other things, but it's the unconscious, basically. That it may be that our conscious mind is just kind of the fringe thing. I don't think it's quite that. I talk about top down and up down, bottom up processing, and top down top down is kind of like you using your intellect, your rationality, your left brain, your frontal, prefrontal cortex to try to regulate those responses from the lower, you know, the midbrain, the limbic system and all that, those emotional responses that we don't want. Sometimes we can do that, sometimes we can't. So when I say switch from ranking to linking, that would be a top-down approach. But a lot of times we can't do it that way. We've got to start from the bottom, which is the unconscious and those emotional responses that are kind of out of control for us, and move up from there. And so this book is an attempt to move from top down. If that's going to work for you, great. If it's not going to, then the chapters get more deeper and deeper into the bottom-up issues.
Let's just go back to ranking for a moment. Moments of crises, emotional moments, you know, you're suffering big losses. Mm-hmm. A person suffers huge losses. You have chemical changes going on in your body. You could be deadly sick. You could be suddenly faced with cancer, or you could be going through menopause. You go through changes in mm-hmm. your body, and the changes sometimes dictate what attitude you're going to have towards ranking. Now, it would just seem that of all the times in a person's life, what they call a male midlife crisis or menopause, for women might be the ranking time of all times. Isn't that when you compare yourself to everybody? What happens during that moment? And why do you say when you're going through a crisis during that period, it's best to protect people from you?
Well, you might also, as you talk about it, I hear it in two ways. Yeah, when you're in a linking relationship, you know, your goal is going to be to protect the other person because you love them, you want to be around them, you want to help them as much as possible, and you know you're a bit of a monster for a while. But it's if you're in a close relationship, you can talk about it with each other. You can say, you can understand, you can make allowances for each other in
but
those
so
kind of situations.
But so few people do that. So few. I mean, I could give, what percentage of you think, people do you think really say, you know, I'm in a foul mood and I don't want you to have to suffer it, darling, because I love you. And therefore, my foul mood may spill over onto you. But please don't believe anything I'm saying. Who do you think ever says that to somebody they love? Besides you and me.
I hope a growing number. It's not that hard. It makes life better for you than if you're grumpy and make. I mean, people who are depressed, for example, people who are depressed are really hard to live with, because, interestingly, my husband and I have studied a lot about including the other person in the self. You've included this person in yourself. When you feel bad about yourself, you feel bad about the other person too. You would think you might, you know, feel inferior, but actually, what tends to happen is you tend to look at the other person and think they're almost as bad as you are. What a terrible thing to do. If you understand a little bit about depression, you can understand that you're putting your partner through a really hard time. And some things are pretty hard to stand back from.
I've seen people who say, therefore, I should free my partner of me. I'll leave my partner.
Well, that's the ultimate sort of selfless thing. But you know, if you really can put yourself in the partner's place, you can see that that would be extremely upsetting.
So I think that's just another way of expressing your anger. You know, I'm going to leave my partner as an act of giving to them. I'll free them of me. I won't be there. You know, it's what you're really saying is that you could work with these moods. And if these moods become pathological continuously, if you're a man who just can't stop abusing somebody he loves, you got to seek help.
Yes, that's pretty much
right. I mean, don't keep saying it's my chemistry.
Right.
Go seek some help. Go and what would you recommend? What could a person do?
Oh, well, as you say, seeking help. But I'm flashing on something else, and I may as well go with it because I've never thought about this before.
Good.
But a person who is physically ill or going through something like menopause or just even aging, if we go with the ranking in a group of animals, let's not say animals, let's say humans, maybe in a, you know, I don't like, you know, in a time when we were hunter-gatherers, say, you're looking weaker to the others. You know it. You're feeling weaker yourself. Now, what human beings have, Carl Jung once pointed out that we're all done reproducing halfway through our lives. Why do we have the other half of our lives? because that's the time when we develop ourselves, our consciousness, and perhaps our wisdom. And the reason why old people were kept around in groups is they had the history, they had the knowledge of the weather and the animals, they had wisdom. So we, you know, the ranking is about influence. So a person in that situation may feel fear, again, undervaluing themselves. I'm no good. I'm actually failing. I look at these young people and look at me, you know. I'm sliding down the ranking. So unless one increases in this psychological way, for instance, how to work with another person in a loving way, unless we grow in those ways, we kind of are objectively failing to live up to what we can be.
Well, you're saying something fascinating here, Elaine, because I think what you're saying is what we perceive is like a slide switch, you know, like a mm-hmm. dimmer in a ranking. You're either highly ranked or lowly ranked. What we don't see is that as one rank decreases, mm-hmm. let's say your reproductive rank decreases, mm-hmm. your wisdom rank is increasing mm-hmm. because there's a direct ratio. Mm-hmm. And in effect, by criticizing yourself and undervaluing yourself yes. as you see yourself becoming less attractive, you're missing the fact that you're becoming this other being that's beautiful, which is the yes. wiser being.
Right.
And that a more peaceful being.
Right. And if you don't work on this, for instance, perceiving, ranking, and linking, and beginning to think about, if you don't begin to look into these things, you really will slide in a certain sense. You don't have very much to contribute.
So then you should start writing books.
Well,
a good time.
Yeah, yeah. I'll tell you something. Oh, should I say this?
Yes, please.
I'll say this. There's a, you know, I don't, I try to avoid using the word low self-esteem because, first of all, there you are, low and high. You know, oh, I'm ranked lower than other people in the amount of esteem. Do I want to have high self-esteem? Do I want to rank higher than other people in self-esteem? No, I really want to be accurate about that and improve my value, not improve my, you know, some inaccurate sense of ranking. But I have a friend who did some research, just happened to do, she's a social psychologist, on the effect of self-affirmations on people, because that is the main thing we use to raise self-esteem. That's kind of our culture is, you know, think positive, think positive. Well, it turns out that people who already have high self-esteem are helped a lot by self-affirmations, but people with low self-esteem are made worse by trying to use self-affirmations.
Get rid of those little cards. Yeah. Those little cards that you're supposed to put on your mirror.
Right.
I'm really okay. I really
yeah.
love me.
Right. I'm a lovable person. That's the one that she used. So we have to work deeply with this stuff. And I believe that everybody can. I'm trying in this book to give away depth psychotherapy,
yes.
depth psychology.
Such a hard thing to
and
do.
And it can't be done alone. We're, you know, our valuing of ourself comes from our stable, loving relationships with other people. The people who know us well and who still love us, that's the value we get. It's not going to come from ranking because we're going to go up and down in ranking all the time, and we know it. Even if you're at the top, you're not going to stay there for long. You're going to always be worrying about who's coming up to get you. So ranking is not a happy place to be. So our value has to come from the love. And so psychotherapy, to me, the most important part of it is the relationship.
It's, and I think it's about love. I think it's about linking.
It is about love.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
If a therapist said to me, if somebody said to me, how do I know therapy is successful? You're kind of, you have this love exchange.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
And they say, oh, how could you? It's supposed to be a professional experience. I say, no.
No.
No, you're going to trust somebody with you being who you are.
Right.
And they're going to not only accept you,
mm-hmm.
but in a sense applaud you for you being who you are,
mm-hmm.
even if you're dysfunctional.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's where you move from an insecure to a secure attachment. And when they interview adults, they actually find people whom they term earned secures. And those are the people who are managed to move from insecure to secure through some kind of a really good, loving relationship, almost always therapy. But I'm hoping that people, a lot of this book turns into how to get closer to people, how to deepen relationships and how to manage close relationships when you're in them. Manage, I don't mean in a manipulative way, but simply having more skills. And, you know, you could write a whole book on each of these subjects. But my point is that for people to stay out of the undervalued stealth, they have to link, and they have to, some of those have to be relationships in which the other person knows you totally. And you can even have moments of shame and still they're within the context of love. Yeah, that, geez, I can't believe I did that. You're still loved.
But I think it's also important to give consideration to the value of surface linking.
And, absolutely.
You know, I don't think we talk about that because we're talking about deep love relationships and therefore hard to find. First of all, who's sane enough out there that you want to be connected to, right? So there's the first choosing mechanism, right? You go to match.com and you put in somebody sane, please. Or let's say you're waiting to meet somebody.
Yes.
There is all this surface linking you could be doing.
Yeah, that's why I didn't talk about love and power, because I feel that we need a term for what I call feeling attracted to somebody. And you know, you can be standing in line in the grocery store and the person next to you, you like them. You don't know why you like them, but you kind of like them. Maybe they say something, or maybe it's just the way they're dressed. It could be you wouldn't like them when you got to know them more, but you kind of like them. You feel inclined to say something nice to them. If you have a little bit more time, it may be that you want to know more about them. If you have a little more time, you may want to do something for them if they're having a... This is what I call linking, and I tell my patients, you know, you need a good meal of linking, you know, several times a week, but you can take snacks all the time.
I had this interesting experience with you when I called you earlier today before the show, as I usually do, and I heard your voice and I said, oh, I like her. That was the immediate thing. So then I offered you tea.
That's right.
And then you responded back and we had this link going, and it's been going on since you've gotten here as well.
Exactly. We both feel it.
Here it is. Yeah.
Exactly.
This is what it's about. This is the way it feels. And what I feel with you is a sense of relaxation, a sense of excitement. I love watching you think. You know, I love watching that happen. It's a really nice experience. And that's this kind of thing that's available to us all the time.
Yeah.
It's things I have with certain people who are close to me.
Right.
You know, it's like I just love the fact that I could feel this, this kind of bond.
It is. It's so delicious in a way. And it's not something that you get everywhere. So you need to treasure it, even if we don't see each other again. We've had a really nice link, and those are some of the most important things that happen to us, I think, in life. And to be able to recognize it and talk about it and say, because the links go deeper the more you talk about the relationship. And in the book, I talk about moving from talking about other things to talking about the relationship in the past, like, gee, wasn't it fun when we did such and such, to beginning to talk about the relationship in the moment, you know?
So
really
talk about that a little
myself.
More. What do you say about that in the book?
About the steps of getting closer? Oh, they're terribly important. I even talk about becoming, you know, trying to offer a really good conversation to the other person, which is what we're doing. Like, you have to put a little effort into a conversation. You have to think about what to ask the other person. But it's like serving the other person good food when you make an effort to have a good conversation with them. And it gets better the more it gets about emotions, the more it gets about the person, the more it gets the other person about the relationship, and the more it's in the present. And there are times...
As opposed to the past or something on the outside.
So if you're talking about something that's strong, has evoked strong emotion about the relationship right now, and it's not an argument, I mean, you're talking really strong, loving, those kind of, I think they're kind of the moments that we live for. You know, I'm very big into Martin Buber and his I-Thou relationship, and we're hungry for those. They just happen for a few minutes sometimes before we're back to it's not that we're not linking, but it gets more muddled. But those are the things I think we live for. I'm really into the fact that we're social animals, even though I am about the most introverted person I know. It's hard for me to go out and meet people, and yet I know that when the relationship gets close, that's the best.
There seems to be something that happens between couples when they're striking for a deeper relationship. Mm-hmm. And there seems to be something that's obviously absent. And that's as couples get older together, and they're beyond 7 mm-hmm. years together, there's a curiosity. I'm curious about you, is the feeling that I have. And sometimes you think, just because I've known you so many years, I'm not curious about you anymore. But mm-hmm. the thing I see in loving couples mm-hmm. is curiosity. Mm-hmm. Tell me what you mean. Tell me what you feel. Tell me what you yes. think. Not yeah. just because I want to counter it or react to it.
Right. Because I want to know all about
you. I really
you.
Want to know about you and yeah. what you feel. Mm-hmm. And when I see curiosity, when I hear couples, like I have a lot of couples who come to see me, nobody ever says, and so could you tell me what you feel about this? They don't ask the question. That's why they're in my office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So. What do you do when something is wrong between you and your partner?
You got to talk about it. That's all. You got to talk about it. And it can be very hard. And I think in every couple there are a few things maybe that you just know you can't talk about, but there should be very, very, very few of those.
What are the few things that you think you can't talk about?
Well, for one thing, I really watch my own ups and downs. Like if I'm in a moment of really not loving my husband very much, I don't have to say that. Unless it's going on for days, then I got to figure out what's going on with me.
You mean there are times that you could feel alienated from him?
Absolutely.
And you could feel like, ooh, he smells bad, right?
Yeah,
and then you have
sure.
that feeling, mm-hmm. and then but
you don't mention that. Yeah, you don't have to dwell on that. You can, in fact, go back to linking and thinking, oh, this I have learned to do, and think about all the things I love about this man. It's okay to do that.
So you try not to take an aversion at the moment mm-hmm. and make it the entire thing, because you know it could be momentary.
Right.
It could be chemical. It could be physical. It could be anything. Mm-hmm. But how do you know when an issue is real? I mean, people talk to me and they say, you know, and she wants to go to school and I don't want to go to school and therefore we're going to break up. I don't get it. You know, she wants to get married and I don't want to get married. Therefore, we're going to separate.
Well,
how do you know when the issue is real?
I like John Gottman a lot, and one of the things he talks about are dreams. That is, people's hopes. And very often an argument is about your dream. That is, okay, I want to go to school, and he doesn't want me to go to college. Well, that's a dream that is terribly important to me that is not going to be fulfilled in this relationship. That's a big, serious thing that doesn't have to do with attachment. It has
but
to
what
do
if that
with
serious,
issue.
What if that serious thing is just about your ranking? What if it's you don't want to go to school because you're feeling undervalued, and so you want to try to value yourself by giving yourself some academic achievement? And really, you might get the same thing by bonding.
It would really depend upon the situation. I wouldn't want to get into that one. It's too many possibilities there.
But you do know the following. You do know that you want to step out of the ranking when you're into a discussion. You want to ask yourself the question, where is my sense of ranking involved here mm-hmm. in this argument that we're having? Mm-hmm. Right? Because you could find you're competitive. You could find that you're feeling devalued, right?
Right. And one of the things I talk about that I think couples really need to know about is what we used to call complexes and now we call emotional schemas, is the same thing. They're really at the core of them, there is a trauma of some kind, and almost all traumas are experiences of somebody else abusing their power and making you feel defeated in a way that didn't help you in any way, shape, or form. So there's this trauma. You're trying to save yourself from being in this painful situation again. So you're, as you say, you might be arguing with somebody about whether you're going to, you know, who's going to go to college and who's going to stay home and take care of the child or something like that. But what it's really about is some trauma in the past. And so in those cases, the ideal thing is that you have learned each other's complexes or each other's emotional schemas, and you know when one has been triggered. And boy, it's not much fun to, it's hard to love somebody when somebody's got one of those things triggered. My husband used to have jealousy as a big issue. And I just, you know, it's like I no longer was important in a sense. It just, there was an obsession going on. Well, eventually I tell people to get a name for the darn thing.
Name it.
Name it and say, I'm in my thing, this thing right now. And
vulture.
Yeah, and I've lost it, and I know what happens when I lose it, and I hate myself when I do this. I've had a lot of, in the past, in my marriage, periods when I couldn't love my husband due to attachment reasons, you know, for chunks of time, and I learned after a while just to ignore those. I remember once calling my husband, I love this, and I don't mind saying it on the air, the embodiment of evil. And I meant it when I said it. And when I look back, it was nothing but a projection of my father onto him.
My guest, Elaine Aron. The name of the book, The Undervalued Self. Elaine, you're an absolute delight. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. This is fun.
And what's your website, by the way?
Oh, well, let's see. There's two. HSPerson.com is where you really get a lot of me. That's the highly sensitive person. But there is a new one with a nice video of me. It's undervaluedself.com.